awake, phones turned off, fully present. Sounds like a roll call for the army or something. Okay, so let's begin to look at this word nibbana in a little bit more context and a little bit more depth, I hope. The Buddha very much taught nibbana as being the heart, the essence, and the ultimate goal of this life. He said, "This noble life we live does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of virtue for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable deliverance of mind that is the goal of this noble life, its heartwood and its end." If you look at the early texts, there are so many ways in which the Buddha speaks about this unshakable liberation. But to give you just some of the synonyms that the Buddha used, he says, what is this unshakable liberation of mind? He said, "I will teach you the uninclined, the taintless, the truth, the far shore, the subtle, the very difficult to see, the unaging." This is some good news. "The stable, the undisintegrating, the unmanifest, the unproliferated, the peaceful, the deathless, the sublime, the auspicious, the secure, the destruction of craving, the wonderful, the amazing, the unailing, nibbana, the unafflicted, dispassion, purity, freedom, non-attachment, the island, the shelter, the asylum, the refuge, the destination, and the path leading to the destination." So you get a sense, you put quite a high value on this. So let's go back to the beginnings. The Buddha, as the story tells us, got up from the Bodhi tree saying, "I have done what needs to be done, understood what needs to be understood. I am a Tathagata, one who has gone beyond dukkha." He declared this awakening in no uncertain terms. He didn't get up from the Bodhi tree saying, "That was a pretty neat experience," or, "I think I'm liberated," or, "Maybe not." He described this unshakable deliverance of mind. And his first discourse in the Deer Park, given to his five former ascetic companions, he described his awakening and liberation in this discourse. And the language and the format he used really to describe that awakening was actually the format of the Four Ennobling Truths, that there is dukkha, anguish, unsatisfactoriness. There is an origin of dukkha in tanha or craving. There is an end to dukkha, nibbana, nirodha, or freedom. And there is a way to an end, the noble, liberating eightfold path. He said, "The cessation of suffering, nibbana, is to be realized and the path to be cultivated. Through understanding these truths, understanding their implications in living in the light of these truths, this is when the heart is truly freed." So what is really, first of all, so important to understand is that when the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree, he didn't describe a state. He didn't describe the achievement of a state. What he described was an understanding, the way that he had understood this world of experience, moment to moment, how it was constructed and how it comes to an end. How the world of unsatisfactoriness and its origins really can come to end. This is the most, I think, first core part of his teaching that is so essential. So we're not talking about sitting and just having some kind of breakthrough moment or our own Bodhi tree experience. We're talking about cultivating an understanding that is available to us all. And the kind of ground for that understanding is where we already are. You know, you don't have to go and find a Bodhi tree somewhere else. This is where we sit. This is where we stand in the midst of the conditions, in the midst of the raw material, we might say, from which we can construct the world of distress, or which we can, through understanding, bring that constructing of a world of distress to an end. So this weekend, I really want to focus on this third ennobling truth, the cessation of dukkha. But I think as we do this, it's really important to understand that we can't extract this third ennobling truth of nibbana from the other three ennobling truths. This is an interwoven matrix. One cannot be extracted from the other. They're all interrelated and they're rooted actually in the immediacy of our lives. So the first ennobling truth, this is where the Buddha started. This is where we are often, I suspect, most of us actually begin. Suddenly waking up to the awareness of dukkha. In all its forms, and none of us are exempt, we don't need to be a Buddha to see the first ennobling truth in our lives. It's part of our shared language, and it's part of our shared experience. And some of the ground I cover here, so you will already be familiar with, but it's so important to actually contextualize this in order to understand nibbana. So dukkha, this messy space. So the Buddha talked about this in three dimensions, the first of these being dukkha-dukkha. Actually, it's the unsatisfactoriness of unpleasant feelings. The pain of pain, whether it's the aging and the frailty and the vulnerability of the body, or whether it's these kind of core human vulnerabilities, you know, the changing nature of all things that we cannot rely on and that makes us vulnerable to loss. The vulnerability of injury, of pain, you know, that all of us will experience in this life. You know, the vulnerability of feeling somehow insufficient, of not being good enough, of not having enough. You know, the vulnerability of the awareness that our lives can spin out of control in any moment. These kind of core universal vulnerabilities that really describe dukkha dukkha, the pain of pain. You know, and you look around in this room and you look at everyone who comes into your life, those you love and those you struggle with, and you know that no one is exempt from this kind of pain of pain. Whether it's unpleasant mind states, unpleasant emotions, unpleasant experiences in the body. Then he talks about viparinami dukkha, you know, the dukkha that is actually brought about, you know, through just the fact that there isn't actually a pilot in the cockpit, you know, and we're actually not in control of all of the conditions of our lives. You know, we simply can't determine that it will stay sunny every day, that, you know, that people we love will never change, that we can't determine that people we struggle with are suddenly going to disappear. We can't determine that the conditions of our lives. And then the core dukkha, the core domain of dukkha that the Buddha felt was so permeable, so accessible, so transformable, is sankhata dukkha. The dukkha of the way that our confusion and our arguments with the first two domains of dukkha can really come to an end. You know, we do argue with the first two domains of dukkha, don't we? You know, this shouldn't be happening to me, life is unfair, you know, why does this happen to me? You know, maybe I'm not good enough. You know, maybe I haven't tried hard enough. You know, the whole resistance, aversion, blame, shame, strategizing, planning, rehearsing, all the ways to get around the first two domains of dukkha, which can keep us busy our whole lives, can't it? This is the core argument that we have. And this core argument, I mean, even Freud, you know, put it that 25% of pain in this life is unavoidable, and 75% of this pain in this life is born of trying to avoid the unavoidable. And this is what the Buddha really sensed. This can be understood. This whole domain of constructed confusion, reactivity, resistance, bewilderment, fear, anxiety, blame, shame, that all of this actually can come to an end. So when does this first domain, this first ennobling truth, when does it become an ennobling or noble truth rather than just bad news? Rather than just something that we need to get away from or fix or annihilate it, it becomes an ennobling truth when it becomes the ground of our awakening. We all know that it's possible to suffer without learning anything at all from it. And actually probably the most difficult piece of advice or we ever get from somebody else when we're in the midst of difficulty is, this is going to be really good for your practice. You know, you're going to really learn something from this. Unhelpful. But it is really, I think, a place of interest for us. When does dukkha become actually the ground of our awakening, rather than something to be fixed? Only at that point when it dawns upon us that some of this argument really can be laid down. That this third domain of dukkha, of sankhata dukkha, is something that can be laid down. And that when we lay down that argument with the first two domains of dukkha, that is when the beginning of a path begins to emerge, doesn't it? That is when the beginning of other possibilities begins to emerge, such as compassion, kindness, courage, fearlessness, perseverance, commitment, ethics. This is when a path actually begins to emerge. It seems so obvious, you know, and yet it can take quite a long time to dawn upon us, you know. When in the early teaching stories, you know, when Siddhartha went out of his palace, he didn't actually live in a palace, by the way, and historically, according to scholars, he wasn't actually a prince. But when he went out of this life, he lived in this very protected world that came actually with money and power and land. When he went out of that very protected world, he encountered dukkha-dukkha, and he encountered viparinami-dukkha. You know, he encountered the reality of the vulnerability, the fragility of this life in the sights of someone who was ill, of someone who was aging, of someone who has died. And it's very, very hard to imagine, actually, that Siddhartha had never seen any of this before. But there was a moment of waking up. And sometimes we have those moments of waking up, don't we? When actually he turned to his companion and said, well, will this also happen to me? Will this also be part of my life? And each time got the answer, yes, you too. You are not exempt. There is no one that is exempt. It becomes an ennobling truth because of the fourth sight of Siddhartha, to actually see someone in the crowd who seemed to be an embodied peace, an embodied radiance, an embodied composure and dignity, because this was a sense of possibility that actually made it possible to embrace the first two domains of dukkha without fear, but with curiosity and with investigation. It is why this possibility of nirvana is so important to claim and reclaim. Because otherwise our lives can be the endless cycles of strategizing around the first two domains of dukkha to fix them or to annihilate them, rather than to embrace them and say, this really is our classroom. There is no classroom and no curriculum outside of this. This is where the process of transformation begins. This was a turning point for Siddhartha, beginning of a path, the beginning of understanding the other three domains of dukkha. It very much raised questions in Siddhartha's mind. Is this all there is to life, of just struggling to get through and struggling to stay away from vulnerability? Or is there a lasting refuge, a freedom from dukkha? This third ennobling truth is not a way to fix the dukkha that cannot be fixed, that is simply built into our lives. The third ennobling truth is a way to understand that we do not have to be a hostage to this, a hostage rooted in fear, a hostage rooted in resistance, a hostage rooted in argument. The second ennobling truth, that there is an origin to suffering, and please really use the word origin rather than cause. This is not a causal relationship. But dukkha does have an origin. And the Buddha described this as tanha, thirst, which is basically, if we put this in contemporary psychological language, you know, this is discrepancy thinking. You know, it shouldn't be like this. This moment shouldn't be like this. I want it to be different than it is. I want you to be different than you are. You know, I want myself to be different than I am. I want life to be different than it is. It is this kind of search, this search of for a kind of projected promise. You know, if I just got this or rearranged this or had this experience or this person or this job, you know, then I would be happy. This is absolutely, completely irrational, by the way. We have to understand that tanha is an irrational project. I mean, can you imagine if someone came to you and looked you in the eye and said, make me happy? How would you feel? I mean, mostly we'd say, sorry, you know, can't actually do it. You know, can't actually do it. And yet the very nature of tanha, or this insatiable thirst for things to be a certain way, pleasant, affirming, securing, flattering, is basically going through life, looking at the world and saying, make me happy. Make me secure. Make me safe. It is curious that we would engage in such an irrational pursuit, isn't it? And yet we see that the ripples of that tanha so built into our day and our lives, don't we? The little moments, you know, it's not the huge kind of cravings, you know. It's just the little moments of just, oh, you know, how do I make this more pleasant? How do I make this less unpleasant? How do I make the pleasant stay? You know, how do I make the unpleasant go away? You know, how do I actually find a refuge or a place of stability in a pleasant, unchanging world? I mean, we can see the problem here, don't we? We are trying to do that which is impossible. As the Buddha put it very clearly in his own teaching, he says, it simply makes no sense for me, who is a changing, fluid, unstable, dependent being, to try and find refuge in that which is equally unstable, changing, and dependent. He says it actually makes no sense. Now, it is often too, I think, you know, the Four Ennobling Truths are often presented in this way, isn't it? That, you know, craving is the origin of distress. Now, we can, you know, and I think it's presented in that way because it's kind of very available to us. I mean, we can see the ways that, you know, craving actually, or this endless thirst actually creates this process of struggle. But actually, we don't always recognize that we're, you know, and the Buddha talks, it says, you know, craving is the origin of distress, but we use craving to try and fix distress, don't we? You know, I don't like the way things are, so, you know, I'll go for the fridge, you know, or I'll turn on the TV, or I'll try to find some way to get something better or make something more pleasant happen. So we get caught in this closed feedback loop of, you know, our unwillingness or somehow our just our difficulty in being with things the way they are, you know, is generating this kind of sense of distress, and then we use kind of mechanisms of craving to fix that distress. So it's a kind of a closed feedback loop, and I think that's really important to recognize. But the Buddha presented, I think, craving as being the origin of distress because we can see it operating in our lives in big and small ways. But actually, we have to also see that there is an origin to craving. You know, craving doesn't arise out of a vacuum. Craving arises out of some very core confusions about how things actually are. Now, you hear that line a lot in this teaching, don't you? How things actually are. See things the way they actually are. If you haven't heard it a lot already, you will hear it a lot. And you will hear it over and over again. And it kind of sounds like a statement of ideology, doesn't it? The way things actually are. It sounds kind of grim, you know. And when the Buddha talked about, you know, aligning ourselves with the way things actually are as a pathway of freedom, he was really speaking about the three characteristics of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, instability, change, not able to offer lasting refuge. The reality, the actuality of change, and the actuality of non-self in all things. This is what he means by the way things actually are. Craving has an origin in distortion. In not seeing things as they actually are, but seeing things from the place of that third domain of dukkha, about how we want them to be. And the Buddha talked about the sort of core distortions that lead to the arising of this unquenchable hunger, this unquenchable thirst. He says, you know, what are the distortions that are the right conditions for craving to arise? Well, it's seen permanence in that which is only impermanent. So just think about that core distortion. We bring it into our language, isn't it, don't we? It's always going to be like this. You know, this can't change. You know, this is the way I am. I'm just this kind of person. This is the way you are. This world I've constructed, you know, it needs to be permanent. It needs to be unchanging. He talks about the distortion of seeing the satisfactory in the unsatisfactory. Can you think of some examples of that? Seeing the satisfactory in the unsatisfactory. I mean, think of just on some basic level, what we talked about last night, the sort of normalization of hatred or ill will or greed, you know, to see that somehow as being satisfactory. Think of it on a more kind of psychological level, to see a life spent in kind of fantasy or pursuit of illusory attainments or possessions, see that as being satisfactory. To think of it being satisfactory to sort of entertain patterns that lead to distress. You know, I mean, I think we live in a world where there's a promotion, a conscious promotion persuading us to see the unsatisfactory as being satisfactory. You know, whether it's the bigger car or the bigger, you know, the bigger attainment or the adoption of a political ideology that alienates and disenfranchises. You know, when we drive down a street and see hundreds on the street, to somehow even that gets normalized as it's just the way things are. You know, to see the unsatisfactory as being satisfactory. It talks about the distortion of seeing the lovely in that which is not lovely. The size 2 on the catwalk. You know, the tendency to objectify things as being, you know, intrinsically desirable, intrinsically necessary to our lives. Think of pornography or addiction, to see the unlovely as being lovely. And he said, of course, the core distortion that really gets all of this going is to perceive and to subscribe to a sense of an independent self where there is only a changing process of selfing. So, you know, it's so important to have this kind of bigger context, you know, because, you know, I think so many people actually sort of get so busy with trying to let go of craving, and that's an admirable task, by the way. You know, we hear that, you know, craving is the origin of distress, so all I need to do is let go of craving. Well, and you wonder why it's so hard, or why that is so challenging, you know. And I think it's because we don't always look underneath and actually see, where does this insatiable thirst actually arise from? And it arises from what in certainly in Buddhist psychology is called avidya, or confusion, or ignorance. And it's really important to be aware when the Buddha talks about ignorance or confusion that there's two parts of it. One part is actually not knowing how things actually are, and the other part, quite frankly, the biggest one is not wanting to know. I don't want to know, actually, about aging and frailty and vulnerability. You know, I don't want to know about uncertainty and unpredictability. You know, I don't want to know that, you know, all of my efforts to rearrange conditions in a perfect way are kind of doomed to be ultimately unsuccessful. I actually don't want to know this. I mean, can you sense how that really, you know, how these kind of core distortions only get sustained because it can feel so fearful to actually embrace them. It can feel so frightening to actually embrace those core vulnerabilities. So we don't want to know, and our not wanting to know is basically what gets manifested in this insatiable thirst and hunger to endlessly secure an affirmed, pleasant, acceptable, worthy, successful me. Does that make sense to you? Pause a moment. Is there anything here that you have an objection to? This is a pause moment. Does anybody have anything that's not clear? Collective forgetfulness. How our society and our culture can be engaged in collective forgetfulness that takes us away from, or endeavors to take us away from, those core vulnerabilities and the way things actually are. So the Buddha says, you know, we learn to step out of this forgetfulness. You know, we learn not to be a part of this collective forgetfulness. And we begin to turn towards, you know, this life as it is right now. It's not like we have to look somewhere else. This life as it is right now, our bodies, our minds, our hearts, the rhythms of change, the uncertainties and unpredictabilities in our lives. And this is when we begin to wake up with that sense of possibility that it's really possible for us to step out of these cycles of forgetfulness that keep us really ensnared in struggle and despair and confusion and hopelessness, to have the courage to meet the life as it is, to begin to entertain the possibility of nirvana, of truly waking up. What is it that makes the second ennobling truth of tanha, or craving as being the origin of dukkha, as noble? It's really understanding this understanding of how dukkha, distress, is perpetuated and re-perpetuated. It takes the mystery out of distress. This is so important. It takes a sense of bewilderment out. You know, those times when we ask the question, how did I end up here? It's often followed by the word again. You know? How did I end up here again? You know, how did I fall, you know, walk off that cliff again? You know, how did I fall in that hole again? How did I find myself in this kind of pattern of argument and contention again? This is what makes it noble, is actually we start to take the bewilderment, the confusion out of distress, and to begin to understand this is actually a process that is trackable and traceable. And that because it's a process that's trackable and traceable, it's a process that can be transformed. It's a process that can be liberated. It's a process of creating, recreating distress. We can step out of those cycles. We can find a very different way of being present within this uncertain, changing, unpredictable life that is simply unable to permanently offer sustained moments of peace and happiness. We can learn to step out of those confusions. We can actually start wanting to know. When we start wanting to know what's going on, we've actually really begun to set our feet on a path. And that path actually leads to the third ennobling truth, that there's a genuine possibility. It's actually only the third ennobling truth of nibbana, the end of dukkha, that makes any of the other ennobling truths make sense. Otherwise, they really are just bad news. You know, if there was no possibility of transformation, you know, who in their right mind would actually really want to turn towards distress? It's so counterintuitive, isn't it? It's so counterintuitive when everything in us screams to sort of get away from this or fix this or make it different or, you know, pursue a better moment. It is only the third ennobling truth, the possibility of bringing dukkha to an end, that brings that willingness and that courage and that capacity. The fourth ennobling truth, of course, is so necessary because, you know, the Buddha didn't actually just leave people dangling and saying, you know, well, there's dukkha and there's an origin or dukkha and maybe there's an end, you know. As you said, there is a pathway, and it's a pathway of cultivation. But the Eightfold Path, which is how this is, the ennobling Eightfold Path, which is how this is usually presented, is both leading to nirvana, but it is also the expression of nirvana. You know, if you want to know what the mind of a Buddha looks like, you know, look at the fourth ennobling truth. This is about embodiment. This is about the living of an understanding, the living of an understanding in our speech, in our actions, in our choices, in how our minds operate. This is actually the fourth ennobling truth, both the pathway to nirvana and the expression of nirvana, the embodiment of understanding. This is not entirely foreign territory to us. We actually glimpse moments of wise view, which is actually the freedom from those distortions that I mentioned. We actually have glimpses of wise intention, You know, and the Buddha speaks about wise intention, you know, speaks about the cultivation and the embodiment of metta, of compassion, and of non-clinging. We have glimpses, for sure, of wise and skillful speech and action and livelihood and effort, mindfulness and awareness. You know, we have glimpses of these. And, you know, in my sense is that the great genius of the Buddha was not about sort of importing, you know, sort of alien complex concepts which, you know, we have no relationship to. And in the great genius of the Buddha was he always built upon what we already know to some extent. You know, it's kind of why it makes sense to us a lot of times, you know. We've all had those glimpses. We actually know the territory, you know, of skillful speech. We know the territory of skillful intention, you know. We know that the territory of skillful effort and mindfulness. We have glimpsed this in our experience, you know. And, you know, my sense is that for many Westerners or people in this culture coming into this practice, you know, we have often a lifetime behind us where we've been encouraged to be somewhat reflective, to have some degree of self-understanding. And so actually we come often to this path with quite a lot of knowing, quite a lot of insight already in place. And the path is one of actually deepening, sustaining that knowing, actually learning to live in the light of what we know. And this embodiment piece, which is actually really the fourth ennobling truth, is actually so crucial to us, because without it we just have more distress. You know, I meet many people who tell me that they thought they were much happier before they started to be mindful. You know, or before they began to meditate, you know, because I think mindfulness and awareness just has this unfortunate effect of highlighting dissonance, doesn't it? It's a really unfortunate effect of highlighting the gaps between actually what we know and understand and what we're actually embodying in our lives. It's a sort of, it can be a long and uncomfortable piece of this journey of waking up, this sort of awareness of dissonance. But we learn actually not to be so judgmental about it. We actually learn actually dissonance is actually the classroom of our path. You know, these gaps between what we know and what we live, or what we understand and what we embody. So no one should feel too alone or too alone in that conscious incompetence. Okay, so a pause moment. Is this all clear for you? We're giving a sort of context for understanding the third ennobling truth. So the question is, what is it that sustains dissonance? You know, what is it that actually sustains and perpetuates this gap between what we know and understand and actually how we live and how we act? Well, I think there's a lot of different conditions. I mean, I think that's, in a way, it's quite a personal question, you know, because I suspect it might be different for different people in this room, you know. What is it that sustains this uncomfortable dissonance? Because dissonance is always uncomfortable, I think, you know. This awareness of, you know, how I'm living and what I know actually leads to the end of distress, or this, you know, somehow the feeling of not having the capacity to affect the changes that would lead to embodiment rather than dissonance. And I think, in a way, it is a very personal and probably a very important investigation to actually see what sustains dissonance. Habit is a big one. Psychological, emotional habits and our attachment to them. Sometimes the fact that actually we really don't want to know because it looks like it's going to take so much effort and care and perseverance to really want to know, to really bring about that kind of unification and the end of dissonance. Sometimes it's actually, you know, simple factors, you know, like the way that we live our lives that sometimes we don't really feel that we have any choice over. You know, the amount of busyness and fatigue in people's lives. You know, if you want to actually see what makes us prone to emotional habits of reactivity, busyness and fatigue are big ones, you know. I think sometimes we still foster kind of like an underlying belief that we just haven't tried quite hard enough to make things perfect. You know, and if we just keep trying to make things perfect and make myself perfect, I think self-doubt is a major factor in sustaining dissonance. You know, really doubting the capacity to bring about the radical transformations that the Buddha suggested or pointed towards. You know, self-doubt is a huge one. All of those, you know, and probably a lot more could be factors in really sustaining that discomfort of dissonance, you know, of not living in the light of what we know. That doesn't make it impossible, you know, because as I said, I think dissonance is actually really needs to be acknowledged as the place in which we cultivate the ennobling eightfold path. You know, we don't cultivate it in the best, most idealized, most realized moments of our life. You know, this is actually what we cultivate in the moments of discomfort. But I think also we have to also learn to be not so judgmental of dissonance and actually to realize, you know, because I think the moment people are really judgmental about dissonance, they get into a whole new flurry of craving and becoming, you know, the kind of craving to become that I talked about last night. I think we have to really learn that dissonance is actually our classroom, you know. It's not a problem to be overcome. It's a domain of dukkha to be understood, you know, to be understood. But then there's other factors in it. If we look at what sustains dissonance, we actually have to look at what ends dissonance, you know. What are the factors we put in place that end dissonance? And I think, you know, a lot of the responses to that are in the Eightfold Path. You know, these are the kind of commitments that we make, you know, to skillful view, to skillful action, skillful intention, skillful speech. You know, this is actually what we actually commit to as a path that leads to the end of dukkha in all its forms, including dissonance. You know? And I think we need to be aware that we don't get so busy on spot. You know, it's very important to acknowledge the causes are what sustains dissonance, and without turning that into a project. Too many Western meditators are working. I mean, working on themselves. They're working on their conditions that support dissonance rather than actually cultivating the Eightfold Path.
And yet the brilliant part of all that exercise is that almost everyone had what they were
searching for. Well, we have it on one level. But it's also quite, I think, encouraging to know that actually we have actually many of the core insights that the Buddha spoke about we already have. But somewhere there's this kind of gap between what we know and what we live. And that's the path. That is the path. Everybody hear that? Just noticing where the capacity to make wise choices gets co-opted by an underlying habit pattern of wanting approval or needing approval or being the perfect self. And actually, I think, you know, that's a good insight, isn't it? That's an important insight, you know, and how much that insight is really related to one of those core distortions that I spoke about of actually seeing a permanent self where there's only a process of selfing and where there is no permanent abiding self that needs approval. Amen? So it's actually quite a good insight that points you back to actually looking at, well, where is that view of self? You know, is it true? You know, is it me? Is it who I am? Because otherwise we get so busy, actually we get diverted by the pattern away from actually questioning that sort of core distortion. So the question is something I just, a remark I made, that, you know, so many people in practice can be so immersed in working on their issues and their difficulties rather than cultivating the Eightfold Path. You know, I think, just as an example, you know, I mean, someone recently said to me after 20 years of practice, it was the first retreat they came on without an issue to work on. And I don't think that would be such an unfamiliar sentiment to many people. You know, our sense, I think it's particularly highlighted, say, in a culture like our own, which so encourages us to strive for a perfect self, you know, as a means of being acceptable and worthy and lovable. You know, it's part of that collective forgetting, isn't it, that this is actually the goal of our lives, is actually to find that perfectly realized, lovable self, you know. And it's kind of where that core delusion, that core distortion about seeing a permanent self where there's only non-self, is really kind of in overdrive, you know, in overdrive. And it's sort of, as long as that is not questioned, of course, it's quite impossible to have a perfect self, you know. That is actually just simply a core impossibility, you know. I've never met one. I don't know what one looks like, you know. I've never met anybody who said they had one, you know. It seems to be the rarest of creatures, a perfect self, you know. And yet somehow we're not convinced. You know, somehow we're not convinced. We think other people must have one. It must just be me. You know, they look like they have one, you know, except in their kind of most vulnerable moments. And so, you know, as long as that kind of distortion or view is in place, then the work is endless, quite honestly. The work is endless. Because if we see that the tendency to cling and identify is always creating the self of the moment, you know, that tendency to cling and identify and contract, it contracts mostly around the unwholesome and the unhelpful and the unskillful. The tendency to cling contracts much less around patience, kindness, you know, compassion, you know. We don't, you know, question that so much. We don't have so much narrative about that. We have a lot of narrative around when clinging actually is seizing upon the particulars of our experience that are unhelpful. You know, I'm so unlovable, I'm so unworthy, you know, I'm so afraid, I'm so ungenerous. So the work is endless, and the work is often unquestioned, you know. It's so weird, isn't it? Another bit that completely makes no sense. That we sort of, you know, imagine that there's this kind of autonomous self that's actually going to work on these issues, rather than the self that is working on the issues is completely implicated in the issues that are being worked upon, you know. It actually makes absolutely no sense at all, you know, to imagine that somewhere in here there's still this autonomous self that's suddenly going to magically arrive and appear and have the right solution. There's a lot of illogical stuff that goes on here, you know. And yet it can be so convincing because, you know, there's so many messages you all receive from everything around you about how you need to be better. You need to do better, you know, and you need to be just different than you are. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to step out of that compulsion without the encouragement to actually really see it as a compulsion. you know, you think about what the Buddha said about these notions of a permanent self, you know, it's a vexation, it's an irritation, it's a fabrication, it's a delusion. It's a hard one for us to really wrap our minds around. Yeah. I know, it is a language issue. It really is a language issue. It's not so much a language issue, it's our associations with language, isn't it? You know, because, I mean, you know, we can try and fudge things all we like, you know, but the Buddha did talk about right and wrong, you know. But, you know, it has a completely different association than we have with right and wrong, you know. Right means success, wrong means failure in you know, our world of language associations. Wrong means you just kind of blew it, you know. Whereas when the Buddha uses the words right and uses the word wrong, you know, wrong view is that which actually leads to distress. It's nobody's fault. There's no blame attached here, you know. It's simply the manifestation of confusion is that there's wrong view, you know, which distorts things. But it's not like there's no fault attached to it. There's no self attached to it. You know, and when he talks about right view or right action, this is what leads to the end of distress, you know, and the end of alienation and the end of dissociation. And again, it's nobody's credit. It's simply just the fact of where this goes and what the outcome is. But I do agree there is there's great language challenges here all the time, you know, just the way that we, you know, start every sentence with I. Or you know, that, you know, the way that we are so immersed in our language into noun and state form rather than process or verb form, you know, so the language is indeed challenging because language informs experience, you know, there's no doubt about it. You know, so there's a way in which actually, you know, there's some very core lessons here about sort of severing the connection between language and association. Severing that automatic connection between language and association. I mean, you know, it can be an experiment to change the language because the Buddha also talks about skillful and unskillful. So he talks about wholesome and unwholesome, you know. Those are big words for us too, you know. I mean, you know, in my social conditioning, wholesome meant Pollyanna. Gosh, am I the only one that old? Some of you are too young for Pollyanna, you know, but it's really no Pollyanna. Yeah, okay. Pollyanna, right, was a big movie when I was a kid, you know, of a young girl who was severely disabled in an accident and yet soared through the whole thing with utter sweetness and grace and uncomplaining and, you know, never, you know, everybody admired her for her meekness and her sweetness. Sweet, sweet. It was a major part of many of our cultural conditionings, was this is how girls are supposed to be. So, you know, it's you know, language is difficult because it does inform experience, you know, so in a way it can be useful for a while, I think, to experiment, but the big thing here is about severing, you know, and this goes right through the teaching, is about severing present moment experience from past associations. You know? It goes right through the teaching, that capacity to, you know, William Blake put it, he says, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. But constantly our perceptions are bringing in finiteness, aren't they? Because we are, you know, I hear the train and I've got a whole world of associations that leads to a certain, you know, kind of reaction. You know, how difficult it is, that challenge is, but it's really actually the job of mindfulness is actually to clean up the perceptual field. So experiment, but actually also just actually also listen to what the Buddha was actually saying in the words right and wrong. And These are not condemnations. These are not judgments. It's just about where things go. It's all about where things go. Yeah? Where they end up. Okay, should we move on a little bit? Any of you still got enough energy? So the first ennobling truth of dukkha, I think we can come to grips with. It can take a while, but after we've all exhausted all our strategies of avoidance and pursuit, and in truth been exhausted by them, we're left with this simple reality that there is dukkha. The second ennobling truth, also not so hard for us to see. We can feel the feverishness of always wanting what is not here. The feverishness of always wanting to become who we are not, or trying to mold the world of conditions in a particular way that serves us well. We can feel the painfulness of insufficiency, the dis-ease of all of this. And we also experience very directly those moments of releasing and unbinding, the moments of peace, the moments of happiness, and we sense what it is to step out at times of those patterns of aversion and fear. And these are glimpses, perhaps just small glimpses, of the third ennobling truth, but we know they're not accidents. You know, those moments of relief, those moments of ease, those moments of peace. We know they're not accidents. They just as disease comes into being through conditions, so too does the ending of disease. It's not a mystery. And the fourth ennobling truth we really do see does actually provide a map. It provides a template, actually, of learning how to live, I think, a dignified life. You know, we think of words other than ennobling or noble. A dignified life, a life without regret, a life without residues, a life where there's a sense of inner freedom. So we come to back to the third ennobling truth. One of the synonyms that is used is Nirodha. Amongst the English translation is the cessation of the outflows. Well, I don't know how much sense that makes to you. It means we stop leaking. Nirodha means actually we've stopped leaking. And what has stopped leaking, you know, it's often translated as cessation, but it's actually cessation of the outflows. What has stopped leaking is we've stopped leaking greed, hatred, and delusion. We've stopped leaking those reactive patterns. This is not how we live anymore. It's often described in negatives, blowing out the fires, you know, extinguishing the fires, absolute coolness, the end of becoming, the end of suffering. But also Nibbana is described in many of the positives, as I read out from that piece. The ineffable and the indescribable, the ultimate peace, the shelter, the undisintegrating and the unfabricated. I think it's really important to acknowledge that ever since the time when the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree, people, students and teachers have been arguing about the meaning of the word Nibbana. So it's not, please don't, I wouldn't ever imagine I'm going to deliver some, you know, ultimate definition here. Some people say, what happened under the Bodhi tree? You know, nothing happened under the Bodhi tree, you know. And I can imagine communities of Dharma teachers and students in, you know, retirement homes shaking their canes at each other as we argue over what the Buddha actually meant by Nibbana. Hmm. In some sense, you know, not so much nirvana, but nirvana is certainly a word that's entered our language, isn't it? It's even a perfume. Never mind a Seattle rock group. But we can still have really sort of an uneasy relationship with this word. I want to just point out that in Asia, much of Asian culture, these are ordinary words, you know. I mean, in England, you know, you might visit a town and you would ask the locals, you know, any castles around here, you know, and they'd say, oh yeah, go down the road, turn right, there's bound to be a castle, you know. It's just kind of ordinary, you know. In Asia, this is ordinary language. In practice cultures, this is ordinary language. You know, you would go into a monastery and you would say, you know, any stream enterers here, you know, first stage of awakening in this map I'm going to talk about, and they'd say, oh sure, few over there and that could, you know, you go to another monastery and they say, well, you know, any sakigamis, anagamis, you know, once returners, non-returners, oh yeah, sure, you know, down here. This is normalized language. And it's important that it's normalized language because it actually begins to enter the realm of possibility. Begins to enter the realm of possibility and accessibility rather than as just being something that happened 2,600 years ago. You know? Ajahn Chah, actually, this, please take this lightly, please. Ajahn Chah once said to one of his bhikkhus, if you've been a practicing monk for 5 years and haven't yet attained stream entry, you've been wasting your time. Anyone here with less than 5 years practice can feel okay, you know. The rest of you might start to feel, oh, you know, what is he talking about? You know? But it's really important that in this teaching, this path, you know, this awakening process, and nirvana is seen to be both extraordinary and also ordinary. Also ordinary. It needs to be an anticipated outcome of right view and good practice. And it is the heart. Now, I think part of the uneasiness of this, of our relationship to the word nirvana, is that they can trigger ambitiousness, you know, and people just feel like they don't have what it takes anymore, or that they need to become enlightened. You know, that's really a difficult term, quite forgetting that it's awakening is the end of becoming. One of the commentaries says, nirvana is, but not the person who enters it. Nirvana is, but not the person who enters into that understanding.